Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 13th, 2016, and welcome to episode 122 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting, and sometimes just random talk about old things of all kinds. Because we're old people. We like to talk about old stuff. My name is Jack Nutting. With me today I have Michael Mulhern from Down Under. How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing good.
Good. And on the east coast of the U.S. we have Paul Hagstrom. How you doing today, Paul?
I'm doing all right. Better than Michael, I think. But
yeah, Michael let us know you had some trouble yesterday, but
Nothing more serious than just passing out and hitting the ground.
As you do.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm glad you are fit for fight today and ready to talk about old computers. So we have a topic we want to bring up at the start of the show today, which is Y2K. Most of you probably remember Y2K, the huge set of problems that affected the world and made all of the microwave ovens crash and cars drive into lampposts and all the things that didn't really happen. Some things did happen, of course. But we thought we'd talk about this because it's one of these things that, looking back in hindsight, it can start to seem a little funnier than it maybe even seemed at the time. I think most of us who were in the industry at the time were also sort of skeptical about the level of problems that people were forecasting were going to happen. But I remember that at the time I was working for a company that had some financial software, and one of our customers, he called me a few months before the switch, so it must have been in probably October, November of 1999. And he called me in a panic. He said, "Oh my God, I went on our test server and I turned the clock forward to December 31st and let it run over the night and let it go to the morning. And there was a certain time set in the morning when the things were supposed to fire up, all of our processes. And the things didn't start." And he was freaked out. He was like, "Oh my God, you guys have a Y2K bug." The problem turned out to actually be that the scripts for starting and stopping all the services, since this was financial software, they were only set to run Monday through Friday. And January 1st, 2000 was a Sunday. So it made perfect sense that the things did not start up. I mean, the customer did not figure this out at all. I figured it out right away because I was like, "Wait a minute, this is not right." But I mean, he was really quite panicked. I think in a way he seemed sort of proud of himself. Like he was like, "Oh my God, I found it. You guys, I found this huge problem you guys have." It's like, "Well, thanks, but no thanks." What do you guys have for memories of this? Paul, I know you brought up some things and you found some interesting things you wanted to mention about this.
Well, I know that like one of the reasons I was thinking of this as a topic was just that we're starting to enter the season of the time zone changes. So right. It was quite a challenge behind the scenes to actually manage to get us all together in one spot because nobody really quite knew what time it was.
That is true.
I don't have any particular stories about it, although I know that, I mean, like in the retro computing connection, I know that it is common practice to just go ahead and set the date for, you know, like 1988 or whatever on the opening screen of your login, just because it's not going to know what you're talking about if you try to say 2016. Though it's always kind of interesting to see which computers can handle it and which ones can't, or which programs can and which ones can't. I know, in fact, there's I think for things that are connected to the network, like the Next boxes, I think there is a Y2K update for those, but I'm sure there's a number of things that are kind of stuck in the middle. But yeah, so I guess I found a couple of just goofy links that related to this. One was from an episode of an Australian television show called The Games that was from, I think, 1998. It was about the preparation for, it was a fake, you know, comedy show, basically mock documentary about the preparation for the Sydney Games. So Michael, you may have experienced this at the time.
Yeah, but I remember watching it way back then, but I haven't watched it since. So yeah, it's just a mockumentary about the not the Games organizing committee.
Yeah, I really actually kind of like the show just independently, but one of the episodes was I think it's called The Millennium Bug, and it part of the subplot has to do with like preparing for the, you know, sort of cataclysmic end of technology that's going to happen, you know, right when the games are going to happen. So I have a little link in there to like one moment where they're trying to explain to the guy in charge like what it is that he's going to have to, like what the bug is, and he's completely not understanding what this is.
Look, let's take Ren, our receptionist, out there. Say he was born in 1970.
He was born in 1970.
Yes, he was. So banks and governments, in fact, any computer system that has his date of birth thinks that he's 28.
Well, he is 28. John?
Yes, I haven't finished. The reason they think he's 28 is because the computer goes current year 98 minus year of birth 70 equals 28.
28.
But when the date changes to 00, the computer goes 00 minus 70. They're going to think that Ren doesn't exist.
They're not going to think he doesn't exist.
Yes, they are.
No, they're not. They're going to think he's minus 70.
Oh, John, can't be minus 70. That's ridiculous.
What? It's okay for him not to exist? I'm going on your logic. On your logic, a perfectly healthy 28-year-old receptionist currently working as a part-time vocalist is going to turn into a sperm and an egg in two people who they themselves haven't been born yet.
John, that is ridiculous. The computers will not recognise the minus symbols. They'll just assume that he's 70.
Why?
Why? Because minus 70 is clearly
stupid,
ridiculous.
But it's perfectly okay for him to not exist and simultaneously be older than both his parents?
Oh, sorry, as much as I'm enjoying this, I'm going to go. You two will have to work it out. I'll see you at the meeting.
We've got to get someone from IT up
here. That is absurd. Bruce, what is IT?
It means information technology.
Hello, Jason. Yeah, it's Brian Dorr. Can you get down here right now? Yeah, right now.
Ryan?
Yeah, thanks. What?
I don't see what all the fuss is about. What did they do the last time this happened?
What, in 1899?
Yeah, why don't we work on that basis?
There's also, there were plenty of survival guides that were published. I found one on Amazon, the Y2K Survival Guide, that has a foreword by Leonard Nimoy. Kind of interesting. And kind of, I don't know, somewhat related. Recently there was going around, I think probably in the last couple of weeks, it was discovered that if you set your iOS device or your iPhone back to, I think it might be any time before May 1970, then it will permanently brick your phone. So it has something to do with what Unix thinks is date zero. But anyway, yeah, I mean, at the time, I don't recall running into very much that was sort of Y2K related. Although I do recall that the power went out, probably just completely independently, right at midnight where I was, which is kind of a little bit freaky. It's like, you know, everyone was kind of like, all right, nothing's going to happen.
I was probably everyone flicking their light switches to see if they still had power.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting time. I was at that time working for a large IT outsourcer in mainframes. And what I found most interesting, it was literally the first major project that I worked on where there was no way that you could push out the completion date for the project. You had a fixed go live date, or it was theoretically going to become a fixed go die date. But dragging COBOL programmers and other mainframe programmers out of the woodwork who thought they'd safely retired, and no doubt were complicit in programming two-digit dates into their programs. So, it was always fun explaining to people that it wasn't deliberate, that basically, you know, back in those days, we didn't have much memory to play with and storage and whatnot, and we couldn't put the century into the date because that would use up too much storage, too much memory. But one of the fun things I had was going around with the PC certification team, and we had to certify each brand and model within a brand of PC as being Y2K compliant. Now, a lot of manufacturers put out Y2K testing suites for their machines, but we had some fairly old hardware tucked away in various parts of data centers, such as old PC-ATs running channel adapters and things like that for printers. And one machine failed its Y2K test, not surprisingly. And we were told in no uncertain terms that we can't use this machine. And really all it was doing was basically supplying a token ring connection and a channel connection for a printer. And there was no use of dates. It wasn't doing any logging. And we basically had to go through a whole pile of rigmarole just to get an exemption to run this machine. And we were in the process of updating it to a more modern machine and more modern cards, but that they just weren't available. You know, some hardware was very difficult to source back then because everyone else was wanting to update their hardware. So yeah, in the end, we finally certified all the PCs and everything, and December 31 went, January 1 arrived, and I wasn't aware of anything breaking, so either nothing bad happened or we actually patched everything. So one of those mysteries. Did we do our job properly, or just didn't it matter after all?
Well, I think it does sort of seem like there was a lot of work that went into it that needed to happen. I mean, like, it's possible that if everybody thought, well, this is not a big deal, then it really would have been a disaster. But it's quite possibly overblown, though.
Yes. All right. So that covers our Y2K coverage. A little late for Y2K coverage, but here we are. If anyone else has any interesting stories to share, feel free and get in touch with us. And moving along to people who have gotten in touch with us, we have a lot of listener feedback. Charles posted on our Facebook group about a computer called a Metaphor that he has, and he's trying to find out more about it. It's a Motorola 68000 based machine spun off from some Xerox PARC technology. And he posted some photos on Google Plus, which may or may not be only visible to those in his circles. We're not sure. Otherwise, he posted a photo or two, I think, in our Facebook group. There's a Wikipedia page about this, but it's nothing that I had heard of, certainly. And interesting to see if you can get this thing up and running.
Yeah, it came as a bit of a surprise to me. I wasn't even aware of the Metaphor, and I certainly hope that Charles can find out some more information. So if you want to look at those photos and you can't see them in Google+, why not pop over to Facebook and join our group and read the posting in there?
Very sneaky.
Ah, yes.
But yeah, what did he say? It's a ML5 1200 from 1988, I guess. But yeah, so if anyone, I mean, I think the reason that Charles asked about it was so that we could ask all of you about it. If anyone out there knows anything about this, I think he'd be very interested.
Did you use one? Have you seen one? Do you have any documentation? There seems to be a sparsity of information about it, so anything that's out there would be gratefully appreciated to get it scanned and get it up there, or even just some reminiscing about it and where possibly there might be more information hiding. So it's one that I want to find out more about too.
Yep. Okay, moving along. Tony?
Well, this one here, Tony's given us a link to a demo of a Civilization-like game for the Commodore 64. Now, I've had a look at this, and it blew my socks off. If you pop over to the YouTube link that we'll provide. It's a very good Civilization. Civ 1 might be the best, closest of the versions, but it appears to be very well done, has great playability, and I really think that for me, this is a threshold moment where I'm going to have to get more serious about my C64 emulation so that I can actually play this game, because I love playing the early versions of Civ. Civ 2 is my favorite on Windows 3.1.1, but I do like the original Civ 1 for DOS. It's quite enjoyable, and if I can even get it running on a Commodore 64, in a Civ-like game, that would be most excellent. So, guys, do you play much of Civilization?
I personally don't. I think I remember firing it up once on the Amiga a long, long time ago, but I never really got into it.
Yeah, well, Civ 2 is basically my go-to game whenever I get a new desktop or laptop computer. I think I might have said this in the past. The first thing I do is I get DOSBox running on it. I load Windows 3.1.1 into DOSBox, and then I go and install Civ 2 because that's my favorite incarnation of the Civilization games. Good graphics, excellent playability. And works a treat on the low-end Windows under emulation. So if you're in the Commodore 64 world, I would strongly recommend giving this a go and get back to us and see what you think about it. But there can't be too many Civilization games out there, in my opinion. More the better.
Yep.
Yeah, there's a post on the, 1164 forum that's kind of like going through the introduction of this by the author who goes by Dr. Kumalo on the forum, and just so I'm not much of a C64 expert, but from just reading this, it's clear that this is quite a feat. He was trying to get this to fit on a basically stock C64, so no extra RAM add-ons, I think it might require a disk, although there was some discussion about whether it should require a disk. And so I think even just apart from the intrinsic interest of Civilization, this is taking the machine to a level that is pretty impressive. I think at this point it's kind of a playable demo more than a full game. But the discussion is interesting too. If you want to read through that.
I'll be keeping my eye on to as soon as I can load it in, I will be loading.
Right. Well, we'll talk to you about it next year then.
You never know. I love these projects where people are getting really pushing the most out of their machines.
Yep. Pretty cool to see what people can do nowadays with this old stuff that we would have gone crazy for back in the day. But... All right, David pointed out that VCF Southeast is coming up April 2nd to 3rd. And this is, of course, the Vintage Computer Festival Southeast edition. This one is in Roswell, Georgia. It's basically exhibits on Saturday and Sunday. There'll be a lot of hands-on activities and speakers. And Bill Hurd from Commodore is going to be there. Jerry Manick, who's from the Apple Industrial Design Group. There'll be some Petra Kucha presentations, which is just like these fast. What is that? You do like 20 slides in 20 minutes or something like that? Is that the format?
Yeah, I think it's something like that. There was just on the Retro Matchcast VCF Southeast 4.0 preview where they talked. There's a little bit of discussion of this weird presentation style. I think it's something like 20 seconds a slide or something.
It's 20 images, 20 seconds each. Yeah, that's it. I've never done one of these or seen this done, but I've heard about this for years. This is like a way to sort of force yourself into a certain structure and a certain time limit.
Yeah, anyone who listens to the pre-edit version of my audio will understand that that's actually going to be mostly just me going, if I were doing it. But
we'll save all those ums for a future outtake edition.
Yeah.
Director's cut. Nothing but All right, moving along, we got from Tony some more feedback from Hackaday about touring the memory technologies of old. I have not even looked at this yet, I'm afraid. But I remember hearing about old memory technologies, and it's probably, it's drums and more stuff. There's some really cool pictures in here when you look through it.
Yeah, some of these I didn't know anything about. It's like they there's some discussion. I mean, it goes way back. There's 1950s drum memory storage, and there's something called Mercury delay lines, which Yeah, you know, and I was actually only kind of skimming through this anyway myself, but it seems like this is actually kind of like a physical recirculation of liquid that the way it remembers is it sort of sends back out the little, I don't know what they are, like bubbles or whatever that it gets in. It's really quite bizarre, but there are nice pictures of those little decatrons and right. Links to videos on core memory and things. Pretty cool.
Yep.
Bubble memory.
Nice pictures and videos and things here of funky old technology. Tony also sent us something about something from Atlas Obscura. They have a page talking about the old Atari Sword Quest competition. It was not just Sword Quest, but was it Sword Quest? There was like a whole series of things. What were they called?
Yeah, like Quest. Water World and Fire World or something like that. There's supposed to be like the four elements.
Right. That was the thing. And yeah, right, there was Earth World, Fire World, Water World, stuff like that. And then the idea was that they were going to give away like an actual golden sword or something to the winner of this. And I feel like I've heard various things about what happened to this, but I have not read this article yet. Maybe it tells it all.
Well, yeah, so I did actually read through the article, and I am not much in the Atari world, so I hadn't really heard about this, but there was this this contest, I hadn't really heard about the contest before, but apparently, you know, there were these prizes commissioned, these like a golden sword and, you know, various things, maybe it wasn't a crown and a chalice or something, and Atari was going to actually give these away to the winners of the contests, and they gave away a couple of them, and there's pictures of the people who got them, but then Jack Tramiel bought the company and the thing was canceled, and it was kind of like this lore about like what happened to the unawarded prizes. And so this is what the thing that kind of bothers me about this article. It says, in the 1980s, Atari offered golden treasures as gaming prizes, most of which were lost to time until now. And that was repeated a little bit later. And yet they don't, they're still lost. It doesn't, the article doesn't actually tell you where, like, we might know where two of them are, and we don't know where one of them is. And, it's like, all right, well, I thought we'd learn something here. It's an interesting story, I guess, but I don't know. We don't know what the... Oh, well.
There's not really a... Not really... We haven't gotten closure out of this. Oh, well. Anyway, yeah, it is an interesting story, and I remember this at the time. I remember these were Atari 2600 games, and back then, in whatever this was, 1983 or 84 or so, I didn't have a 2600. I was on computers already, but I remember friends who had this. Like one friend in particular, he was really pretty excited about this, and I don't know how much he actually did to try and get far enough to try and be, you know, I have no idea what was involved in actually sort of winning this thing, but I remember having a friend or two who were excited about this. So it was interesting to sort of hear what happened, if anything happened. But anyway, let's move along. A bit more news from Tony. Thank you, Tony, for sending in all these things. He mentions that season 2 of Halt and Catch Fire is now on Netflix. I have to say that I haven't even watched season 1 yet. I'm so far behind on my watching of this show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't watched season 1 yet either, apart from the pilot intro episode?
I think people can complain about individual little issues with certain bits of technology and, you know, certain plot points about how there would have been a much easier way to do X and that they would have known that and that sort of thing. But it is still pretty cool to see like all the old computers around, and it's entertaining. The first season ended a little bit weirdly, and the second season, you know, I think it got a little better. But it's, I would say you can't really not watch it. So... Anyway, it's more available now because Netflix is a broader platform. It was previously on, I think, I don't even know, TCM or something.
I'll have to see if it's available here on Netflix Australia.
Yeah, it's one of the things I've been meaning to look into and have not gotten around to it. But I will try and remember to put on my list of things to waste time on.
I think, by the way, I'm pretty sure it's AMC and not TCM, but
okay. Let's see. Moving along to one more bit of news from Tony. Benj Edwards, a couple days ago, did a slideshow of PC games with ASCII graphics. And I think, Paul, you had something in particular you wanted to, you were thinking about with this.
Yeah, only just that I, you know, well, so this is one of those PC Magazine slideshows where there's, like, you know, something like 10 slides, and, you know, it's kind of interesting to see these, and most of the ones that he had put in these slides were, you know, various role-playing games and things, but it reminded me, the reason I wanted to get this one in is it reminded me of the Tetris clone called Niet that I played incessantly when I was working, like, I was supposed to be a lab assistant, and I was stuck at a PC. Like, normally I would be using Macs, but I was stuck at a PC in the front, so I would spend, you know, no one ever needed, I didn't know any statistics, I only knew computers, and no one had any computer questions, they only had statistics questions, so I spent, you know, I was basically paid to play Tetris for an entire, like, year or something.
Nice.
So, anyway, the game, yeah, it was nice, and they had actually a projection screen in that room so that you could even, you know, play it very large. Anyway, so
perfect.
I guess plus one ASCII games.
Yes. Cool. All right. I think that's all the user feedback or reader listener feedback, user reader listener, something, people feedback that we will deal with this time. We're gonna move on to some other items of interest and news that have come up. The first one is something that I've noticed that I have spoken about before. We've talked about the Retro VGS games system that was supposed to be underway, which eventually kind of their Kickstarter failed, and Coleco said they were going to pick it up and they were going to have this thing called the Chameleon based on that. Well, apparently it is now dead again. Things are reporting that Coleco has officially come out and said, we're not doing this because things weren't going the way they thought they were going to go. So, Retro VGS, I mean, those the guys behind that still have their project, still have their technology, and may do something else with it, but we don't know. So there's kind of one more page in this saga of whatever's happening with this thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do remember when we talked about this before too, that it's a weird concept that is not, I have yet to be convinced that making new hardware cartridges is the thing to do, but, maybe that's part of what the problems are, but yeah, it did say that Coleco's, they've decided that the work they've created is not sufficient to demonstrate at this time. So.
Yep. So we'll see. Maybe that will rise in some other form at some point. But for now, it looks like it is dead again. Michael, you have something you want to go to.
Yes. One of my favorite board games and computer games is Go, or Othello, or any other computer-based interpretation of it. But what was interesting is that Google's AlphaGo has just beaten the Korean grandmaster Lee Sedol after winning its third straight game in a best-of-five series. I thought, well, it's not going to take too big a computer to beat me. As much as I love the game, I'm not exactly a grandmaster status. You've got to be kidding status. But it got me interested in how the computer Go has appeared throughout our retro computers. So thanks to the MOS 6502 group for a few extra links. First one I've got is the British Go Association reporting on a computer versus computer game of Go back in 1984. So they've got it listed there as the two programmers. It's got the play actions in their 1984 issue of their newsletter to members. So if you're interested in that, go have a look. And then there's also programming or playing Go on a Kim. So there's an article in the Byte magazine, April 81. So that's available in the Internet Archive. So that's got a very good article on how to go about playing and programming the game on one of our older machines. And my favorite game is from Quintic from Nibble This is a February 1986 game, so I'm not quite sure. I don't think Quintic's available any of the free-to-download disk images that are available, but if you want to purchase the February 86 issue of the Nibble magazine, if you're a Apple II person, it has the type-in program in there, and I thoroughly enjoyed that game because it had a nice... basic learning AI, and it would start off pretty much just randomly putting stones onto the board, and it would basically analyze you, the opponent, and would develop countering strategies. And in the end, I would get to the stage where it would be countering me all the time, and I would not be winning, and I would say, well, that was an interesting round, delete computer user, and let's start again. And if you're a real die-hard Go fanatic, I'll also provide a link to a four-hour commentary documentary of the first match between AlphaGo and Lee Sedol. So that's 3 hours and 55 minutes of gripping commentary on the game with in-game analysis and blow-by-blow commentary. So, guys, were you ever a Go fanatic like me, and hopefully if you were, you could actually play it better than I.
I enjoy Go in theory. In practice, I'm just terrible. Like, to me, I've never encountered a computer player of Go that will not just beat me, like beat the pants off me within a few minutes. So to me, the fact that, like, I don't know, it doesn't seem that impressive that a computer beats a human at Go, because that happens to me all the time.
I think that the human that got beat might have a few extra CPU cycles over your style.
Might have a bit of an edge over me. But I have a question, though, about this four-hour video. So is the actual match 4 hours long, or did they pause it to, like, talk about it?
Oh, good question.
Okay. You didn't watch all 4 hours to actually.
No,
find out.
I skipped through it. It was too much to go to for me.
Yeah. You start watching and say, "Oh, it's still another 3.5 hours to go."
Yeah. Ah, I've just seen on the news wave here in our notes, the mysterious typer said that Quintic is in the Stavros collection. So I think we'll need to provide a link to that. So that's nib27b.dsk. We'll have Quintic on it for you.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a Stavros Karatsouridis. It's pronounced something like that. Typed in some time ago. Pretty much all of the Nibble type-in programs, and made them available. And it's actually available on nibblemagazine.com, where the scans are for the magazine as well. But the type-in programs are all freely downloadable.
They're all free to download. The magazines are a purchase item.
Yeah. So I was just sort of, as you were talking, sort of flipping through the catalogs and found 27B is the one that has Quintic on it. So.
Mm. And cool. I thoroughly enjoyed that game. But as I said, it didn't take long for the computer to stop me from winning. But that's a problem that was easily fixed with a delete.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. Moving on. Paul, you've got some news about 4 a.m.
Yeah. So it's a sort of just a brief thing. But Jason Scott put a blog post up actually at archive.org. Entitled Saving 500 Apple II Programs from Oblivion, and it sort of talks about the 4 a.m. collection and the fact that, like a lot of these previously unpreserved games are now actually playable on the Internet Archive. It's a big story. In a sense, it's a kind of an incremental story because I've been, wowed by this all along. But this particular post managed to get picked up by a lot of people and sort of went viral in a way. And it was, and in fact also managed to get sort of misinterpreted and then copied around in a misinterpreted way.
Oh, that
way
never
in various
happens.
Ways. Yeah, so.
The internet is so clumsy.
Right. So, so in fact, 4 a.m. is actually one person cracking things, and you know, it's amazingly prolific, and actually has gotten a lot of stuff sort of put together to automate some of the process, and it's really quite something. But this often had been repeated as if it were like anonymous or something, or like, you know, some sort of hacker collective. But it's actually, not only is it an amazing number of things that have been cracked and made available, but it's also just one person that's done it. Right. So anyway,
all the more impressive.
So yes, definitely. So anyway, it was this is a thing that's in the news, and if you read it anywhere but archive.org and didn't already know the story, then that's what the story is.
Well, they could read this one, and then they could read any of the others, and it'd be just like getting two stories for the price of one.
That's true.
Bonus. All right, Michael, you've got a follow-up on something we talked about a few weeks ago, the Amiga 600 add-on.
Yeah. So for any Amiga 600 owners out there who were undecided whether they should get the Vampire 600 for their machine, and I think you should, there is a short film clip of a Amiga 600 using NetSurf NoFPU. Starts off with the Google page coming up, and then pops off there. And I just think that this is just so interesting that with new tech add-ons, that our good old favorite computers can live and work in the modern world. So here we have an Amiga 600 running a web browser, connected to the net, browsing just like it's always meant to be, and it's quite impressive. And I just love the way that people are getting our old retro machines back. I won't say as their main daily driver, but it's excellent to see older machines living and working in the modern world.
Yep, that is very cool. It's a cool little video showing old school Amiga OS running a web browser and looking at Google and doing some stuff. That's pretty neat.
Mm.
Pretty cool.
So yeah, it's a great demonstration of the Vampire 600 hardware. It's not just running an old program faster. It's
right.
You know, if you look at it, it's you're using a modern day LCD screen to display it. You're using current network topology to connect to the internet. You're using Google to go off and do something. So you know, it's pretty much you drop the 600 out of the picture and put in your PC, your Mac, your Linux box, or whatever, and it's just as if you were doing something that you would do every day. Yep. It's just wonderful. I just love it.
Yep, it's cool. I posted an item here that this is something that is not new strictly, but is new to me. It's basically there are a pair of projects that are related. There's one called OS/A65 and something called Geckos/A65. These are both multitasking OSs for the 6502. And these have been around for a long, long time. I think the work on the first one started in 1989 or so. And there's it's basically a user on 6502.org, someone named Andre, who is seems to be behind both of these. And he's posted a bit of his thinking behind this and how they work. And basically, these are Unix-inspired multitasking OSs with protected memory and multitasking and all the stuff you expect from a proper operating system. These seem to be set up to work primarily on Commodore machines, so I think you can run them on a PET, maybe on a Commodore 64. I'm a little unclear on exactly where this thing seems to work everywhere, but. Anyway, it's interesting. It's very this will run on C64 as well. We'll do that. Hmm. Yeah, so it's worth taking a look if you're curious about how someone would go about doing this sort of thing. You know, we tend to think that you need to have modern computers to do modern type stuff, but you know, basically he has an approach for doing I/O and dealing with the file system and all kinds of stuff using the old 6502. So We'll have a couple of links in the show notes about this. Have any of you guys heard of this thing? Heard of this before?
No, but it's definitely something I want to track down and have a bit more of a read about it. Anything which gets a little bit of extra oomph or functionality out of a 6502 has got to be good.
Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had not come across it before, I think, but you're right. I've had a decade to do so. So, interesting.
Well, they do have the most the important 8 bits to work with. The other 56 bits is just fluff and graphics.
So true. Let's see. Next up, Paul, you wanted to mention podcast interviews here.
Yeah, only just kind of like briefly. Just it seems like there have been a lot recently, and so I thought I would mention Bill Budge was just interviewed on the recent Open Apple podcast, which is, you know, he's someone that they've been trying to get for a long time. It's neat to hear him. On Drop 3 Inches, we interviewed Taylor Pullman, who was there at the very like early Apple days. He was product manager on the Apple III, so that was and he actually has lots of really cool stuff to say about just like early time at the at Apple. And of course, you know, a whole parade of people have been interviewed on Antic.
And who would be doing all those Antic interviews? Is there anyone we know?
Let's see. I think it might be Kevin Savitz.
Ah, yes.
But
well, mostly Randy Koenig's doing some as well. But
yes,
Kevin is mostly responsible for the fire hose of interviews that we are being blown away by.
So. Right. Yeah. And also we need to mention his name once per podcast at least. But
it's in his contract.
That's right. Although, so speaking of mentioning people's names, there's many, many names. There's lots of podcasts to listen to, basically.
Yeah.
Just to continue on Antic, there were at least a few of, you know, obviously it's primarily an Atari 8-bit based podcast, but there were a few that were people who kind of influenced things in other micros as well. So Dave Pratt from Digital Vision that made the Computer Eyes, and Jerry Jewell, who is the co-founder of Sirius, Bill Loudon, who is of CompuServe and Genie, and David Crane, co-founder of Activision and writer of Pitfall. They just posted something by Bob Pullen of Synapse, who wrote Blue Max, which I think was on several platforms. I'm pretty sure I remember that from the Commodore 64, but I mean, it was also clearly on Atari. The second episode of TRS-80 Trash Talk has come out, and they thanked us for mentioning positively their podcast. So now I will mention in return that they thanked us for that, so then they can keep this circle going possibly indefinitely. And anyway, yeah, but no, this it's a good time to have a lot of spare time in transit to listen to things.
Yeah, so any of our listeners who aren't subscribed to the Antic podcast because it's not their flavor of machine, I strongly recommend that you do subscribe to the podcast because so many of the interviews that are being done are cross-brand. As soon as you start talking to software developers and things outside of Atari, they're invariably going to have relevance to all platforms, and it's just great to sort of hear the stories of the people who were actually there, that that ran the companies, created them, wrote the software. It's just great to listen to.
Yep, it is a lot of fun. I'm about 20 episodes behind, I think, right now. Maybe 21 by the time I finish saying the sentence. But I feel kind of bad because I always I send them an email now and then, but like I'm always I haven't been caught up since, I don't know, October, November, and I feel like by the time that I get around to one of the episodes where they're talking to each other instead of interviewing anybody, oh yeah, I wanted to write to them about that interview with that person, but now they're already talking about that, and they talked about that 2 months ago, and I'm hearing it now, and I'm so far behind in my cycle of being able to interact with these guys. It's terrible. What can you do? But it's great fun to listen to, and it's like you said, so much of the stories from these people are, you know, they're not specifically Atari stories necessarily, and like some of the things you hear, you know, when you hear somebody who was like working on the customer service, on repair stuff of things that were sent in. You know, these things that are not necessarily specific to Atari, except that person was doing it there. But like this would, you know, this could be a story from anybody working any tech company in the early 80s. And it kind of like, it's just interesting to hear these stories from this era, because those of us who were alive and maybe, you know, kids or young adults at that time, we experienced things as consumers. You know, we experienced the consumer end of actually buying the products and using them. But it's just interesting to hear the stories from the people who were creating all of this stuff. So you go, Antic, and everyone else interviewing people. You go, everyone. You're doing it. All right. I think that's enough news for one day. It's time to move on to a word from our sponsor.
To meet this need for high-speed data processing, the scientists and technicians of the Eckert-Mauchly Division of Remington Rand have created a miracle of electronic development. UNIVAC, a complete electronic system for sorting, classifying, computing, and decision-making. Here's how it works. As the individual reports come in, the unitypist transcribes them to tape. These tapes are then placed on the Uniservo and acted upon to get the base earnings record of each employee for that pay period. From these production lines are coming the electronic data processing systems, which are beginning to play such an important role in our daily lives. Powerful servants designed to further mankind's future progress in all fields of endeavor. This is UNIVAC. Tomorrow's miracle of electronics, here today.
Okay, that was great. That sure brought back memories, huh, guys?
Certainly does.
Wow.
There's a risk here that you're going to let people behind the curtain.
I remember the first time I heard that. Anyway, moving on, this is the time of the podcast we get to the retro computing gift idea. And today we'd like to talk about Tetris 3D cushions. These are available at thinkgeek.com, and they are cushions shaped like Tetris pieces. And so you can buy these cushions and stack them up on top of you while you're sitting on the couch or lying in bed. There's a nice picture of someone sitting on a couch or bed with these cushions, also having on top of them a blanket that has Tetris pieces and says at the bottom, epic fail. I can't see what the actual fail is because the blanket is crumpled. But it's worth seeing the picture, and it's worth buying the cushions for someone you know who loves Tetris. Honestly, I think these would be fun. I think the price they're asking is kind of outlandish, but it's cool anyway.
They do look like nice, you know, like soft pillows, I guess. Yes. But yeah, it's even on sale, it's $90.
Yeah.
So yeah.
They're pretty big.
Well, for five cushions, mm-hmm. But
yeah, it's five cushions, $90. It's not too bad. Could be worse. Mm-hmm. What is that? $18 a pop? Not too bad.
That's right. Could be worse. It could be $100. Or worse, it could be $150.
See? But it's getting better all the time. Right. Imagine if we're a million. Now 90 seems cheap.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just looking at dimensions. So, yeah, the eye is 5.5 inches by 22 inches by 5.5 inches. So, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's pretty big.
That's a sizable pillow.
Mm.
All right. So, moving on, we are heading into the eBay auctions section of the podcast. And I found something that I think is pretty cool. This is the Pocket Pokey Custom MIDI Synth. Basically, what this is the Pokey chip that was used in the Atari 8-bit computers for doing audio. And someone has taken this chip and repurposed it into a device that you can plug in via USB to your computer and use as a MIDI synthesizer. This is kind of a one-off thing, and the one that I'm looking at right now, they said this is the first one of limited run, and it's actually going to, the auction for this is done in a few hours, so it'll be too late for this one. But it seems like they're going to be making more of these probably. So the current starting bid on this, looking at it, 3 hours left to go, is 89 US dollars with a buy it now of 150 and zero bids. So we'll see. I would not be in the market for this thing for $89, but for some amount of money, maybe. It seems pretty cool. The idea that you can, you know, make these crazy Atari 8-bit sounds without having to use either an emulator or an actual Atari 8-bit, but just have this little pocket-sized thing that you plug into your modern systems. And I also added some links here that are for some videos showing how this thing works.
It is pretty cool. I mean, maybe it, like upon a minute's reflection, it would have seemed obvious to do this, but it's pretty cool that it's a MIDI device, mm-hmm. you know, that you can control it in amongst all of your other MIDI devices too. So that's cool. It's true that I don't know that I would get one, but I would respect someone who did.
Yep. And I respect the person who put this together. Seems like a cool thing. Let's see. Moving along, Michael, you have some Commodores down
there. Yeah. I always like to sort of see what's available for Australian listeners. There's so much good stuff out there in the North American market. But every now and again, some good gems pop up down here on eBay. So the first one I found was a Commodore 64 in the breadbox style, which is my preferred. I think that's sort of, to me, the iconic Commodore shape. I suppose it's because I quite liked the VIC-20, so I like the Commodore 64 not in the flat wedge. And it's not much information about it, but it does say that it is in working condition and currently has 6 bids on it currently going for $86 Australian. So I know that in the North American market you can normally pick up a Commodore pretty cheaply, but by standards down under, if it goes for 86 or not much more, that's not too bad for the console itself.
Cool.
And the other one is a VIC-20, and it currently is no bids, starting at $40. In the comments, it does say that it looks like some chips are missing from the main board, comes with a 110-volt power supply. So it looks like this one might have been cannibalized for parts at some stage. So if you're willing to take a risk on having the right parts available, or that it might have the parts that you need, that's, again, not too bad. But very hard. I'm not finding too many VIC-20s in the eBay auctions down here, but it's definitely something which, you know, I think you've got to get from either one of the European or US eBays if you're after anything like that. But it's good to see a Commodore 64 breadbox turn up. That's quite good.
A pre-loved working computer.
Yep. Yeah.
Pre-loved.
I love that brown color.
Yeah, it has a nice sort of like coffee feel to it.
Yeah.
I saw a photo. I forget. Sometime in the last couple of days, it went by. Someone was posting something about having gotten a VIC-20, but the badge said VC-20 and not VIC-20. I was just now looking around, and apparently it was marketed in Germany as the VC-20 and not the VIC-20, just because I think if it had been called the VIC-20 there, it would have reminded people in German of something that was like some sort of obscene word or something like that. So they decided, you know, like it's just going to be a VC-20. So there's slightly more detail about this on Wikipedia. But
that sounds familiar. I do know a bad German word that sounds like Vic. So, yeah.
So, anyway, apologies to our German listeners if we are offending you by talking about the VIC-20.
What can we do? That's what it's called. All right. Cool. Glad you found some Commodores down under there, Michael. Paul, what do you want to share with us today of your plethora of items you have proposed?
I put a kind of big list here, but we'll see what happens. But I came across what looks like a actually fairly nice Rainbow 100 machine, a Deck Rainbow 100. The seller has split it up into pieces. So I think you need the keyboard. I think is not specific to the Rainbow, but I think the monitor might be. And so if you ever wanted to assemble a Duck Rainbow 100, you need to get a particular monitor for it and the keyboard that goes with it. And unfortunately, even though the seller's not starting these at particularly much, so the main computer's starting at $50 and the keyboard starting at $20 and the monitor starting at $30, they are all separate. And so if you are starting with none of these pieces and you wanted to put this thing together, then it could be kind of nerve-wracking to try to... Actually, I didn't look to see if... I know the monitor ends later. They don't... At least they don't all end at the same time. So if you get the computer, then you can start pushing on the monitor or whatever. But so anyway, I know that I had been looking to... looking at the Rainbow 100 just as something that might be interesting to get, although I'm not sure that I was ready to commit, although it was partly just because you need these specialized pieces. And so these look like pretty nice pieces. So do either of you know anything about the Deck 100?
No, unfortunately not.
I kind of feel like I've seen one of these somewhere, but I don't really know. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, the look and feel is familiar, but I've never actually used the Rainbow, so I've had a little bit of hands-on with some deck equipment, but not the Rainbow 100.
I think I kind of want to get someday some kind of Vax. I think just for, because I actually knew a little bit about what was it called? MVS? VMS?
VMS?
Which is the Vax one.
VMS.
But VMS, yeah. I did a little bit of programming in that, writing just little scripts that would do things. As I recall, yeah. Actually, yeah, perhaps, Jack, you had some interaction with this. But in college, people would do things like play these games. There was one called Assassin, which was a physical game that you actually, you would be assigned, basically you were supposed to try to assassinate somebody by, you know, essentially you just, I think you have to give them a piece of paper or something that says boom or something like that. But right. You have to do this when there are no witnesses. So the way this would work is you'd actually try to get people alone so that you could give them this thing, and then you would advance in the game. But so the reason I'm saying all this is that the way the computers were set up at the time, which was like 1990-ish, there was a terminal room, and people could log in at the terminals, and you could actually query the VAX to see who was logged in, and not only who was logged in, but at what terminal. So I had little scripts that would stalk people this way. And anyway, whatever. So VMS reminds me of all of these things. And the Rainbow 100 doesn't run VMS, I don't think. So
on that, did you have to actually assassinate them in person, or could you then sort of send a user message?
I think you had to actually, hand them the little piece of paper yourself. I forget exactly how this worked.
Well, there were a variety of ways you could kill someone. There were either there were certain toy gun weapons that were allowed to shoot people with, or you could poison someone by putting Tabasco on their food. That was a sneaky thing to do. Because I was actually running this for a while, the assassin thing, and there were all kinds of different rules of how you could, different ways you could, and it was, the idea was, I guess, to make it more interesting over time. We came up with different things. So if you would, you could, right. You couldn't assassinate someone if there were people around, unless you were wearing a mask or something like that. So it evolved into this terrible thing where people are running around with masks, running into the dining hall, shooting people with plastic guns. It's nowadays people get arrested.
You could get away with that back in the 80s when I was at university, because we played it as well. But no, I don't think that's. I don't think it would work too well today.
No. In this day and age, not recommended. People are still playing this at Carlton, Paul, because I still get email from them now and then.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, anyway, yes, VMS, it was a thing, and I remember using it also, and I have no idea if the Rainbow runs VMS.
Right, but I don't think so. I think when I was first seeing this, I was thinking that this might be in the VAX line, but I don't think it is. I think this is I think it's a CPM machine.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see. So one thing that is still there, I didn't know if this would actually survive until the recording, but there is a vintage Play School Play and Learn computer, which is pretty cool looking. It's a $40 US buy it now. It looks like it ships only to the US, but it is from, I think, 1972. Yes, 1972. It's a kid's toy that has these little cards that you put in, and you can sort of like it somehow. I'm not sure how it asks the question. Somehow it asks a question that you answer by sliding a little device, and it'll tell you if it's right or not. But it looks like basically a tape drive for a mainframe. It's pretty cool.
It is cool looking, and it says no batteries needed. It does not need batteries.
Awesome. And it has a little, I don't know what you call it, bit bucket, you know, place for the like, paper tape waste to go, where you store the cards. But, anyway, very nice.
Pretty cool.
The other things that I had, so I can probably go through them kind of quickly, but they're all like large or complete bundles. So one is a relatively complete Atom, a Coleco Atom, and it looks actually quite good. I wonder if I should buy this, but at any rate, it's, you know, so the Atom, we talk about the Atom repeatedly. It has a printer, and you need the printer because that's the power supply. It has a main unit and a keyboard. This particular keyboard seems to have had stickers put all over it. I'm not sure quite why, because the stickers say the same thing as the keys do underneath, but, at any rate, it's sort of colorful, and this one comes with several cassettes, and the controllers. It looks complete. You know, if you're looking for one of these, this is one of the more complete ones I have seen. So, there's also a Color Computer 3, which is a kind of a similar thing in that it's a very complete setup. So it's got the Coco 3 itself is actually a fairly somewhat hard to find and desirable thing. It has a expander, like a multi-pack interface for putting in several cartridges. Comes with a tape deck and also a double disc drive. Many cartridges, many manuals. It's not cheap, but it's maybe only on the high end of reasonable. So it's $350 buy it now. Again, ships only to the United States, sorry. It also has one of the X pads, like a graphics tablet type things. So it's actually a pretty nice setup. Let's see. Maybe I will mention the one last thing since I'm one from done with my list, which is basically just a Timex Sinclair bundle that looks like it has three computers and it looks like it has three computers, maybe it's four. I'm not sure if there's one in the box. Several 16K RAM modules, a printer with the box, and relatively nice looking user manuals. But if you are interested at all in sort of like the Timex Sinclairs, one of these probably works. So
that is an instant collection.
But plus. Yeah, the boxes are in nice shape, and I kind of like the boxes; they look nice. Most boxes that I see for these are much more beat up than this. This one is not great. They must have been made out of like Kleenex or something, because they really do. I guess I have a couple on my shelf that look about that good, but I mean, like, you know, this, even this, they all have some tears in them. So,
yep.
I hadn't seen the printer box before, though. That's kind of nice. The 2040 little, it's, you know, slightly bigger than a receipt printer that goes with it. Looks kind of nice. So, if you're interested in that, this is a $75 starting bid. And again, they all ship just to the U.S. Sorry.
Darn the luck.
But the pictures are nice.
Mm. Just one note on the Rainbow 100, that although it can't run the VMS from the boot menu, you can put it straight into a VT22O mode and connect in. So as well as running DOS and 8-bit and 16-bit CPM, you can just flick it straight into a terminal mode without actually needing any boot disks.
Cool.
Oh, that's cool.
Nice. All right. Well, I think that wraps up our eBay auctions, and that wraps up almost the show. Any parting words, anybody?
No, the only thing I've got is who will be member 100 of the RCR Podcast Facebook group.
Oh.
Yeah. Just added member 99 today. Nice. So we'll see. Anyway, I think member 128 might actually be a more important milestone.
That's right. Just a bit more important. Well, let's see. I had... I think exactly after we recorded the previous episode, where we speculated about, it looks like there's, you know, some sort of information about the Raspberry Pi 3 that was leaked or, you know, became available. They pretty much went on sale like the day after.
Right.
So,
scooped it.
Yeah. But then of course the podcast came out a little later, but, yeah. On the day that they came out, I went, you know, to try to get them, and you couldn't get the boards anymore, but you could get these starter kits, which I would have wanted anyway. It came with a case and a power supply and the SD card and the unit itself.
Okay.
But it was the site was just completely overwhelmed. This was, I think it was MCM Electronics, and they just could not handle the demand. So I went through the process of trying to buy one of these repeatedly, over and over again. And eventually I did finally get to a screen that said, you know, congratulations, you know, here's your order and your receipt or whatever, you know. Mm. It turned out I wound up having ordered two, because two, like, you know, I wasn't sure how many of those had actually made it through, because, you know, you'd hit the, like, submit button and then it would never come back to you.
Right.
And So I have two of them now. I haven't done anything with them really, except assemble the cases, but it's pretty cool anyway.
Nice. Cool. Yeah, I've not yet ordered one, but one of these days I'll get around to it. The nice thing about waiting to buy any Raspberry Pis, though, is that there always come new models that are just way better and the same price as the old ones.
Right. That's true.
You have to break out and buy it sometime, though.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm pretty sure that I bought my... like the first Raspberry Pi, I think I actually bought it on eBay for kind of a lot, you know, back when they weren't available and they were really quite new. And then I didn't use it for like a year and a half. So it was totally worthless.
But, yeah, I think I'll have to get one of the threes. I've got one of the originals, and it is feeling a little bit, it had always felt a little bit slow on some of the things I'm doing with it, so it had helped to have a bit of a gruntier processor in there for some of the video work that I'm doing. But I like my Raspberry Pi.
Cool. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, gentlemen, I think we did it. We reached the end. You can find show notes for all RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss it in the forums at www.vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. That's the new home, same forums, now part of the Vintage Computer Federation. You can follow RCR on Twitter, of course, at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group by searching for Retro Computer Roundtable or by going to facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can email us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a proud member of the Throwback Network, where you will find plenty of other podcasts, people talking about old stuff, at throwbacknetwork.net. Please write a review on iTunes and give us all the stars. And until next time,
Retro Compute.
It's March 13th. What did you say, 1916? You threw me off there totally.